new CBS Monday.
Federal agents!
Hands where we can see them.
NCIS Hawaii is back. New criminals to catch.
Armed robbery, aggravated assault, murder.
And new investigations to be solved.
These guys were good, but even masters make mistakes.
Vanessa Lachey and featuring LL Cool J.
Violin Island, you got it.
Welcome to paradise.
A new NCIS Hawaii, Monday, 10, 9 central on CBS and streaming on Paramount+. Plus.
Get fired up.
Oh, yeah.
Performance-enhancing audio.
This is the State of Combat Podcast with Brian Campbell.
Wow, the new theme song rocking out, jam band style, but it's still the same old State of Combat Podcast on CBS Sports with your boy BC. MMA today with the one and only, the Hall of Famer, a pillar to his society.
He makes gun signs with the right hand and animal balloons with the left hand.
Yes, he's a credit to his community. It's the Hall of Famer, Sugar Rashad Evans. My man, how is it?
Oh man, it is good. Hey, listen, not as good for you, not as good for me as it is for you. We have nice theme music now. Okay, I like it. Okay. Hey, every hero needs his theme music, and I guess you got yours now.
There it is, right there. Never a bad idea to switch it up, freshen it up a little bit. Rashad, we are fresh off in this MMA world. 8 crazy nights, right? I don't mean to get I don't know what faith you practice, but these are 8 crazy nights we just endured and enjoyed.
Instead of one air presents, we get 8 crazy nights.
And 3 fight cards. And MMA was back, and I'm here to be excited and celebrate that with you. Only now we got a week off. It's like, what do we do now? You know what I mean? I feel like we're going to get fights from this day forward till the end of the year. They're going to pack them in, MMA, boxing, whatever else. But how are you feeling after kind of, you know, getting back on that horse a little bit the last week?
Man, I'm feeling good. That felt amazing, you know, and I felt as if like everyone was thirsty for it. And those fighters went out there and they performed beyond what was expected of them. And it just goes to show, you know, how much that fight meant to them and the support that rallied around the fight and Dana White putting it all together and the UFC being able to take that whole crew that they have and just show how amazing they are by being able to throw 3 shows and then implement all the new practices that goes along with having these events. It was impressive.
Yeah. It was obviously great to get back in the groove for us who are employed in this business. It was great to be doing what you're supposed to do. I think it was great for everybody who's missing live sports. But on top of that, the cards also kicked a ton of ass. I mean, you know, Saturday, we're going to be specifically this week breaking down, of course, Saturday night's fight night card, UFC Jacksonville 3, whatever you want to call it. But I mean, just that card alone, I feel like every performance, you know, gave you something to talk about, was an elevation of the one before it. Man, the fighters dug in, short training camp, weird training camp or not. They dug in and sort of like, it was like an unspoken thing where everybody got together and said, not only are we going to bring these fights back, not only are we going to help open the doors for all of sports to come back, but oh, by the way, we're going to bring it in the cage. I guess maybe the craziness was fuel for them.
It really was. And it was almost like they made a pact, you know. It was like, you know what, we can go out there and fight as hard as we can. And there's no losers in this. And you kind of seen that with a lot of those fights. You know, I'm thinking about the Cowboy and the Anthony Pettis fight. You know, that was an amazing fight. And there was a winner, but there really was no loser in that fight. And that was the gift that, you know, a lot of these fighters, they gave the fans. You know, it was impressive, man. And hats off to Dana White once again to be able to just stick with what he believed in and make it so that we got live fights and we were the first ones to lead the charge in it.
Maybe I'm wrong. And if I'm wrong, then the corona's going to get
No.
All right? It is what it is.
No, Dan. Danny, you did well. At the end of the day, you did well. Boxing is going to follow you. You hear Eddie Hearn is trying to put fights on in the backyard of his mansion. Bob Arum is looking at June 9th as a comeback date in Vegas for that. Bellator making plans. They're looking at maybe late June, early July. So you're going to see everybody following. We've seen Arizona open up the doors, New York threatening to open up the doors to pro sports. So kind of like we predicted, if UFC could do this correctly, and for the large part, a couple little hiccups, but the large part they did, we're back. And that's great to see. One of the headlines we're going to talk about, of course, is what's next for UFC on the schedule. And I think, you know, once the state of Nevada, Rashad, finally, you know, awakens and says, there is a safe way we can do this. It seems like that's the safest thing you could do for the UFC, yeah, is let them stay home, right? Not take this traveling thing on the road. Let them stay home, fly in the fighters, stay in the PI, get your test, and you're good, right?
I mean, you would think so. I mean, being the fact that, you know, Vegas is the other state like Florida where they have the same tax situation. So, you know, you would want to think that they keep that money there. It just seems really weird that, you know, they were one of the ones who kind of led the charge of letting everyone back and opening up conceals and everything. But then at the same time, not leading the charge when it comes to athletics. It just kind of seemed like there's a disconnect there in the politics.
Absolutely. And I'm still shocked. I'm still shocked by two major things in this quarantine. One, that the state of Nevada in Las Vegas particularly decided to somehow be the moral voice in this whole conversation of, nope, sorry, we're shutting down. And two, that the sport of boxing even took a break, Rashad. I've been in boxing a long time. It's a dirty sport. I'm shocked that they were like, go ahead, UFC. You guys be the first. We'll just wait back and wait. But that's Dana White. That's how he got this far. Give me a South Florida quarantine update. We're all living the same but different quarantine lives, whether you live in an urban community, whether you live more spread out in the suburbs, your quarantine life is probably different. But South Florida seems to be opening up. How have you adjusted to this?
It's been going pretty good. You know, still got to get used to a lot of the rules and regulations and knowing, you know, when to cover and things like that. But for the most part, people are getting out and they're, you know, they're being social, they're being active. And that's what I was really worried about, you know, on the heels of this whole thing. How are people going to interact with each other? And I feel as if, you know, people are starting to interact with each other and, you know, in a safe way. And, you know, life is starting to return back and the energy is starting to return back to South Florida.
All right. Put it on me, right?
I want you to put it on. I want you to try to do your best to put it on me.
That's what I'm talking about, it because that's how I get down. All right. We're going to take a quick pause for the cause. On the other end, we got all your latest news this week in the news cycle. John Jones, Francis Ngannou, could it be? Breakdown of UFC Jacksonville 3 and more. That Conor McGregor guy still lingering in the background. As always, we'll get to that and more after this break.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
The hit Paramount Plus original docuseries returns.
The last time I saw Max, he looked at us laughing, and then everything changed in a blink of an eye.
My feeling as a detective is that he was murdered.
Yahoo Entertainment calls it a spine-chilling docuseries showcasing real-life tragedies.
What if it was your child who went missing?
We need to know the truth.
Never seen again. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Yeah, we're back. It's BC. It's Sugar Rashad Evans. And Hall of Fame, sir, you and I jumped on CBS Sports HQ this weekend right after that fine bit of entertainment UFC provided in Jacksonville with the fight night card. Obviously, the heavyweight main event was the big story. Could Walt Harris, you know, find some happiness in this crazy journey of losing his stepdaughter while also simultaneously making a pretty serious leap up in the heavyweight standings in terms of title picture if he could get past the trusted old guard veteran that was Alistair Overeem. What a wild fight in the end. Overeem via second round stoppage. But Rashad, tell me if I'm wrong. Our guy Walt Harris, who, you know, credit to him and his family, how could you not cheer for him? I mean, he was as close as it seemed you could get to forcing referee Dan Murigliotta to jump in, maybe one clean strike or one, you know, flurry of shots, and it just didn't happen. He slips up on a wild front kick attempt, and it was all downhill from there. I mean, I don't want to make this, the way he lost this bigger than the larger picture of what's going on in his life. That's a bitter loss, man, to have it go down that way.
It really was. And it was hard, you know, to watch, you know, because I love Alistair Overeem. You know, I've known him for years and old training partner of mine. So I pull from him. You know, I pull from him a lot of times when he fights. So it was kind of weird to be pulling for Walt. And, you know, I just felt as if, like, there was so much emotional pressure on Walt, you know, that he put on himself. But, you know, when you get into a fight, there's so much emotion in general. In general anyways, you know, so when you had mixed those emotions, it just becomes a big mess. And it looked as if like he was handling it pretty well. And as if like, you know, things were going to work out for him, but he wasn't able to handle the upswing, the swings of the fight. And sometimes when you're too emotionally charged, handling a swing of the fight may be too much. You know, when Alistair started to rally, it may have broke his mentality and may have put him in a negative state, like, oh man, I can't believe I'm losing, and whatever the thoughts may that happen from there. But for the most part, that mental pressure is a beast, and I wouldn't wish that on anybody going to the cage fighting.
But you said that because I was going to ask you whether you that sudden fatigue drop, the stamina drop that led to the finish. Certainly, we credit Overeem, who, I mean, look, how many years, like Arlovsky, on a smaller level, but like Andre Arlovsky, how many times do we say, nah, it's over for Overeem, the chin at the elite level just isn't there? Well, he got bloodied up and got exploded on and adjusted so well. So he did the veteran things, like taking Walt Harris down after he slipped, leaning on him, pushing on the gas tank. We certainly saw that and believe that. But how much of that stamina dump was mental, do you think, in the end, for some of those things that you just said?
I think a lot of it was mental, to be honest. You know, you can kind of see that the way he was breathing after the first round, you know, and even partly through the first round, you just kind of see him, you know, breathing a little heavy. And, you know, they're big boys and they're throwing some heavy punches. So you got to give that and respect. But at the same time, you know, when I fought John Jones, that was one of the fights where I came into that fight so emotional, and he came into that fight emotional. And I remember when we first exchanged, our first exchange, we both like fell over in a very clumsy way. Just, it was like an emotional exhaustion that we both have, and we just hit each other, and it felt like a weird moment, and we both recognized it in a weird way. And I think that's what Walt was feeling, just that emotional dump. And that emotional dump is harder and heavier than an adrenaline dump, because with an adrenaline dump, your body, it seems like it adjusts different than it does when it's like an emotional dump.
It's crazy because the same emotions, you know, that we thought might fuel him, and it seemed in the first 2 minutes of the fight, it was fueling him. He looked like the big ticket. He looked like the next heavyweight in line for that minute and a half, 2 minutes when he's hurting Overeem. But the same emotion seemed to turn against him there. Separating the story, and look, I do want to sort of take a mea culpa. I said publicly on different podcasts and stuff, you know, he could have had this happy ending and it was ruined, this fairy tale ending. And people reminded me, what's the fairy tale here? He lost his, you know, he lost his stepdaughter.
Right.
Like that's much bigger than any kind of win against, and I respect that and appreciate that. But so, you know, I credit him and his family. I credit Overeem for being a gentleman afterwards, saying, let's train together, offering him up. But if we can take the emotional story away from it and just focus on what this fight meant for the division, did this tell us what we needed to know about Walt Harris at this point? Not saying his career is over, not saying he's never going to get to the title level, but at 36, five-fight unbeaten streak coming in, we wanted to know, is he for real? Did this humble us to know that there's still work to do?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there is a lot of work to do. And, you know, with Alistair Overeem, you know, we forget that what he did to Rozenstruik, you know, 4 minutes and 50 seconds, for me, 5 rounds of 4 minutes, 50 seconds of that fight. And what he did, what was crafty, it was smart. And it just shows that he's head and shoulders above a lot of the rest of the guys in the competition when it comes to just the cerebral mindset to fighting. So there is levels that Walt needs to hit. And Alistair Overeem is a good marker for that. The grappling aspect is something that he's going to have to definitely work on if he wants to compete at the higher echelon. But I think for Walt, I think it's something that he can do very easily, because I see the mistakes that he made in that fight, and they weren't huge mistakes. They were just some positional mistakes, and that could be, you know, due to the fact that, you know, he was emotionally fatigued and just physically fatigued, and the fact that you have Alistair Overeem, who is so talented with his grappling that it gets almost unrecognized. You know, that inside arm lace that he did, that is so hard to get out of, and it drains the energy out of you.
Yeah, absolutely. And here's the credit we give Overeem. He turned 40 in, you know, about an hour after the victory. A couple minutes after the victory. And he's a man. Come after him. He's 40, that for sure. What does this do? I mean, look, in the thing about the heavyweight division, we always say it because it's true. Age doesn't seem to matter. I mean, look at Cormier and Miocic right now are both, you know, 37 and 41, whatever. I would guess it would be unlikely to see Overeem get back to the title level, but is it really that unlikely?
No, it really it's not really unlikely, and I'll tell you why, BC, because I honestly believe that he should be the next matchup for Francis Ngannou, provided that something doesn't happen with the whole John Jones situation.
Trying to get that man killed. I mean, seriously, did you see their first fight? I mean, did you see that left uppercut from hell?
I know. But that goes to show where Alistair Overeem is at. You know, he's pretty much, underneath Francis. I would say he's the guy. You know, he's been chucking along at a pretty good pace and beating these up and coming guys and challenging these up and coming guys. I think I don't know, man. I think Alistair, he can be in there. I do think so, man.
I think here was my problem in not maybe giving Overeem the respect he deserved. Once he stopped being the Overeem from Strikeforce and Dream and you know, from Pride and from those days. And he came into UFC, destroyed Brock Lesnar. He seemed to still be that guy. But then he was, you know, taking those losses against the Bigfoot Silvas and guys like that, where he was leading in the fight, looking great. And then he sort of just gassed or got caught and gave it away. And I know some people say maybe the PED testing and the prior organizations wasn't the same it is in the USADA era. But with that said, once he stopped being the monster, I was just like, okay, well, it's done. You know, he's in the second half of his career. He's done. He's a name now. Well, I have to be reminded that he almost beat Stipe. Like, even outside of the joke about Stipe tapped, he rocked Stipe and was on top of him. And you know, he could have been your heavyweight champion right there. So I can do nothing but sit here and applaud him for being able to take experience. He's not the same guy from Pride who's going to knee your face off, right? Destroyed Liddell. But he's more skilled than most of the guys in that top 10, or if not all of them, to be really honest with you, short of maybe Cormier. I mean, That can last a long time.
It really can. And you mentioned his fighting style change, and it had to, because like before he was a very striker dominant game, you know, and he had such an edge on fighters where he would just destroy them with a striker, and that's all he needed to use. But once the playing field leveled out, he started getting caught a lot and getting knocked out a lot. So then he lost the advantage with the striking, and then he lost confidence in the striking, and then you didn't see him strike the same. But when he started to use more of his well-rounded game, using his great clinch, using his ability to grapple and just even lean on the people on the cage, you know, that's when he started to be able to put his striking around it and start to compete with some of these guys who he should have been getting knocked out by.
That's a good point. You know, when he was so as good as he looked against Stipe at times, remember he was also circling away and almost running. And you're just like, that was, you know, maybe that was a confidence issue period for him, despite getting to the title level at that point and almost, you know, upsetting the champion. But mentally, he looks back, and that's great to see. So there's certainly still life for a guy who's had an insanely legendary career, a big win. Talk to me this about matchup Monday here, okay? It's not even Monday, but you get what I'm saying. We're going to talk John Jones and Ngannou next. That's going to be one of our big topics. And it could, for all we know, it could be Ngannou, Stipe. Like, you know, we'll see what UFC is going to do there. What about Alistair and Derek Lewis? Love or hate that?
Right. I love it. I think both of those guys are put on. I think Alistair would make Derek Lewis fight a little bit harder than he normally does. Because sometimes Lewis can go into a shell, but I think with somebody like Alistair, I think it'll bring him out.
All the training and all the sex I've been getting, my body needs some time off.
Yeah, well, hopefully he's always getting that time off now. You know, we know his balls get hot indeed. we got to run through this card because it really created a ton of conversation. A lot of it, though, due to the judging. So I want to have this debate here, Rashad. We had three very close fights, split decision wins for Claudia Gadelha and Dan Ige, and a unanimous decision win for Song Yadong, in which all three seem to sort of rightfully produce those who felt the loser should have won, and some who have made it a larger discussion about the obvious problem we seem to have in MMA scoring using a boxing scoring system for MMA, which is a long-run conversation. But just the idea that the judges got it wrong, that there was something in the water in Jacksonville on Saturday. Now, personally, I didn't think they did. In all three fights, they had the guy that I thought won. But it brings up a larger debate within this fact. Using the MMA, boxing scoring in MMA, meaning the 10-9 must system, it doesn't really work. We know that. MMA rounds are 5 minutes. There's more time for ebbs and flows and things to happen. Yeah. But I still feel like these three fights were victimized by the idea that everyone sitting at home with a beer isn't an expert and isn't always scoring it round by round. They score it on a visual whole. So when you watch Claudia and Angela Hill, and by the way, Angela Hill was the better fighter on this night, but it doesn't always mean you won the fight because you're scoring round by round. So unless you're giving Angela Hill a 10-8 second round in which she dropped Claudia, or unless specifically you thought she won two of the three rounds, it may be easy to sit there at home and go, oh, well, Angela landed the bigger damage. She had to have won. Right. When people need to realize, again, it's round by round. And in the third round, I thought Claudia rallied enough. Some people disagreed. But where do you sit on that divide? Yes, we score damage in MMA. Yes, damage wins out. But you don't score damage as a whole. And I think people still don't get that. Like, you score it round by round. So unless you're giving somebody a 10-8, it's still a math equation in the end. Claudia didn't look great by any means, but I thought she did just enough. Where did you stand on those?
Well, yeah, those decisions were very close. I went the other way on the Angela Hill and Gadella fight. But that's the thing about it. And I don't mind the fact that I went the other way. And I don't mind the fact that on a split decision, I thought something and somebody else thought, the judging thought another thing. Because that's what can happen when there's a split decision, you know? And it's not the fact – it's a testament to how good the fight was. And there's going to be close fights where there are split decisions. Now, every single time there's a split decision and it goes to one person versus the other one, you can't always cry corruption. You know, you can't always cry bad decision. It's just sometimes there's going to be a divide on what the consensus feel on a split decision. And that's okay. You know, that's okay, because at the end of the day, it's the fighter's job to prove unequivocally without a doubt who won that fight. And if it comes to the point where it's that close and it's a split decision, then it is what it is on either side. And I get the argument for both sides, but at the end of the day, it's the game we play.
It is. And there's a far big difference between disputed and robbery / controversial, right?
Right. There's a big difference in that. Yes. Yes.
Robbery way too much. Robbery is when somebody seemed to have won 3-0 and they lose three rounds, you know,
that's a robbery,
whatever.
Right.
Look, here's the deal. Claudia, I don't know what happened, Rashad. She's been in such amazing shape. I know she had some heartbreak in terms of her last two fights falling apart. She had wanted to showcase this new Mark Henry striking style and round out her game. I don't want to diminish from what Angela Hill did, because she took the reins of this fight and made it her own. Even though I thought she got edged out on the scorecards, again, she was the better fighter. She had the more dominant periods of when she was in control. I feel like this is almost one of those wins that's a loss for Claudia, because she didn't really look in great shape. The explosiveness wasn't there. The gas tank wasn't there. I'm certainly willing to give her a pass given the quarantine and you know, not everybody responds well to a weird training camp.
Right.
But this was almost a lateral to a back step in some ways.
Yeah, I didn't see the improvements that you would expect from having those two camps. But, you know, at the same time, I felt as if, like, you know, Angela Hill provided a lot of problems. And when you're looking at Claudia's game, you have to respect the fact that Angela's not the same person. You know, she's not the same woman who left the UFC after the Ultimate Fighter show. She came back you know what I mean.
Ricky.
She came back ready, right? She came back on point. With that, she's gotten better with her coaching, and she's taken that to the next level. So she's a lot different when it comes to, you know, she's on another level. Now you take Claudia, and Claudia is, you know, she's getting a new system, and she's learned the Marcus Henry system pretty good, but you know, she still looked very truculent to me. You know, her punches didn't have that snap. She looked kind of slow. And it didn't look like her. She had the confidence in her stand up moving forward like she used to have.
I agree with that. How much do you think of Angela Hill's, you know, evolution here? I mean, it's rare to do this at her age, right? She's 33. It's rare to have a kind of figure out, you know, in the smaller weight classes, exactly who you are and make this run that's been great. Four really strong performances in a row. How much is that tied into activity? Because this was her seventh fight in 14 months. The only one who has ever had more fights in a shorter amount of time is Cowboy Cerrone, and it was by like 2 weeks, the difference between that. Not everybody could or should fight seven times in 14 months. But what does that do to you if you can stay that consistent?
Well, what it does, it unmasks that beast that sometimes fighting becomes in a fighter's mind. You know, sometimes when, you know, you do fighting and you get some success with it, and you start to be afraid to lose, and you start to be afraid to compete, you know what I'm saying? And then pretty soon fighting has become a phantom that is bigger than what it was for you before. But I think Angela, by fighting and just, you know, learning how to deal with that moment, learning how to deal with short notice fight, and learning how to deal with an opponent that she had little time to do preparation for, allowed her to learn how to make adjustments in the fights. And now when she's out there and she's fighting someone on the level of Claudia Gadelha, okay, she can lose the first round and then make adjustments to the second round and come out and look good like you've seen her do, because she has that experience of going in there with somebody she doesn't know and then taking that lump in the beginning and then figuring them out and then getting back after it. That's what fighting short notice can do, and that's what she's proven.
Yeah, Claudia does get the win, like we mentioned. She said in the interview, look, I want Carla Esparza again. They had fought to a very close split decision over the, I think about a year and a half ago. And it was funny. Esparza responded on Twitter, made mention to Claudia greasing up too much in their first fight, and Claudia telling her to shut the F up back at her. But that's certainly a match I don't hate. I just don't think Claudia is there yet to, like, go above that, to start getting the Joanna trilogy, to start getting back in that title picture, rematching Andrade, which, by the way, would be a hell of a fight. I hope Claudia does, because there's some great matchups to make. I mean, her and Rose Namajunas, for example, would be an incredible style matchup. But I hope this is also a lift to Angela Hill. And I hope, you know, it's a continued evolution of the idea that losses don't kill you, that you can grow from them. And I think a big problem with that has always been the boxing side of it. And sometimes I add to that problem as a boxing guy without realizing it. We put so much stock in this padded, built-up, unbeaten record that once, you know, a prospect gets a first loss, well, he's done, he's done. And sometimes that permeates into MMA. And I even want to take an L on when we were cautious of Tony Ferguson taking the Justin Gaethje fight. We were cautious because he had a 12-fight win streak.
Yeah,
he had Habib already signed up, even though it fell apart a bunch of times. And it was the idea of, you're 36, your window's closing, now or never. You take this Justin fight and you lose, you're done in this deep division. I heard Eddie Bravo, though, on that Joe Rogan Fight Companion podcast, that he's his Tony's grappling coach, jiu-jitsu coach. And, you know, he made something really poignant. He's like, I already talked to Tony the other day. Tony is already looking at this loss like the best thing that happened to his career. He's ready to come back right away. He's already training. He was dancing in the hospital, and he framed it like this. I broke the quarantine in the first card. I headlined it. I made a crap load of money. I was in a fun-ass brawl in which, you know, I showed a lot of good things. And, oh, by the way, I'll be back in a big fight real soon. And it did wake me up. It's like, he's not going to, like, the back of the line. Right. You know, Tony Ferguson could, for all we know, be one big win away from getting right back into a interim title level fight, a BMF title fight, or whatever.
I mean,
you know, so it's like, we got to realize that he took a chance. He switched camps. He was preparing for Habib, and he was the company guy at the last minute, said, no, I'll fight Gaethje. He'll get rewarded for that. The guy's not going anywhere, is what I'm saying.
He's not. And honestly speaking, that may be even a matchup for Conor McGregor. Maybe that might be something that will be fun, right? That'll be fun. Tony Ferguson, Conor McGregor. I mean, and, I would love to see that.
I'm not even that afraid for Tony's age, because I look back on that fight, and certainly we can say shouldn't have cut weight 2 weeks early to prove a point. Maybe shouldn't have accepted the fight. You can say all those things on top of it.
Right.
But Tony, and maybe you can say, shouldn't have taken so much punishment, right? Like, maybe the corner should have thrown it, whatever.
Right.
You could argue all that. Yet Tony showed a gas tank in that fight, Rashad, that I don't think I've ever seen. And what I mean by that is he got hurt so many times, yet was like instantly recovered and right back into pushing the pace, that 36, the age is a number. Like, he's not dead. Yeah. He's not, you know, he's still super elite. Now, you fear if he's going to take damage like that, you know, too often, but that guy's a different breed, Rashad. And I just wanted to give him that moment and shout him out.
No, he is, though. I mean, but you talk about his age. He is older, but at the same time, you have to realize he took so much time off. His body wasn't taking so much damage. So, you know, you have to, you know, that's what makes you get old, when you take the damage on top of it. You know, his chronological age is one thing, but the actual abuse on his body is another.
Good point, indeed. Quickly up and down this card, the featherweight battle, Dan Ige, Edson Barboza, split decision. It gave another debate about the scoring, and shout out to Edson Barboza because, you know, he stayed in that fight. I thought his gas tank was compromised a bit by the weight cut, but he showed toughness. He knocked Ige down in the first round. He landed arguably the biggest damage in terms of singular moments. But Rashad, the reason why I was happy with Ige getting the win is I thought he was the guy pressing the pace more at the end of round two, throughout round three, which round three was a close round. And when he got that big sort of takedown, like, I felt that he had really bounced back from some legit issues in that first round. And when he hit that flying knee, that was like, I'm in this fight, okay? I know you're the bigger badass coming down. Wait, I'm in this fight. For me, the guy who wins the most on this card is Dan Ige. He, 6 wins in a row, he just made the leap into legit top 5-7 title contention in my mind from this win.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've known Dan Ige when he was fighting in little shows that nobody knows, and working with Ali in Vegas as you know, his errand boy, and now he's at that time, you know, he was a young athlete growing into what he is right now, and now you see in that fight, I just watched him grow up right before my eyes, watched him grow confidence in his game and believe, you know, he is good enough to be in there with these guys. You know, he doesn't need to be in the back of the line. He doesn't need to be these guys' training partners anymore. No, he's better than these guys. He can beat these guys. And it was good to see him start to believe in himself. And, you know, with the guys that he trained alongside, with Khabib and, you know, all the other, you know, Kamaru Usman and all the other great opportunities he get to train with, now you're starting to see that he believes in himself, and now he's starting to mimic the level of skill that he's trained around.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought I saw the guts, the cardio, the ability to change his attack and alter it up and figure out a way to get that fight. Again, it's disputed. I have no problem if someone thought Barboza had done enough. I just credited Ige's work ethic. The larger conversation for Barboza is, though, Rashad, at 34, this is now his unfortunate, you know, 5th loss in 6 fights. Is this a good move for him? Now, personally, from what I saw, I mean, that looked like a horrific cut for a guy who's already in such great shape to go down 10 pounds. Yes, he saw the power early. I just don't think it's worth it to cut from his potential gas tank as he gets older, even though there's a shorter path to a title in theory at featherweight than that crowded-ass lightweight division. I don't know. I didn't get the feeling like he necessarily belongs. Some people disagree with me. That's fine. What do you think about Barbosa's future coming off of this?
I actually thought he looked good in that weight class. I didn't think that he compromised too much of anything. I thought he still looked fast. I thought he looked really strong. I thought he looked big. I just think that when it came, like you said, in the end, those same cardio issues that he had, you know, I think that he just didn't, or just really hard to prepare for what the end of that fight is going to be like, as far as the pace that Dan Ige was going to push him through. You know, Dan Ige really brought it out of him and made him use those legs a lot. And I think it really kicked in that gas tank, and cutting that extra 10 pounds, you know, that had a dramatic effect on those legs. But I would like to see him there again, and just more time to get used to being at this weight class, because I do think that he could be dangerous in his weight class if he gets his body acclimated correctly.
Interesting. We'll see. I mean, look, we had the same doubts about Jose Aldo, and I thought he really looked good against Marlon Moraes. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But big win for Ige. We also saw Song Yadong, the featherweight, very close fight with Marlon Chito Vera. And you got to give Vera credit. He kind of did what he always does. Start off a little bit slow, but make the adjustments where you're like, he may have done enough. I mean, this was, of the three fights, this wasn't a split decision. It may have had the biggest argument to be won. I didn't have an issue with Song Yadong winning it, but I also was fearful for him when it went to the cards, because this was a good fight. They both pressed the pace, and it was about as even as it comes.
It really was. I thought that Cheeto really did a good job in there, utilizing some of his, those clinch positions and things like that. But Song Yadong, he landed some really clean shots early out, and it really left an impression in people's minds, you know. But Cheeto showed that he's got a lot to him. I was hoping that he was going to use more of his Dan Christensen wrestling. That was my wrestling coach when I would do some fights. And
that's your old Ultimate Fighter, housemate, right? In fact, I remember, when you saw him walk through the door.
I'm like, holy hell! I
know. No, Daryl's a smaller guy. He's an Olympic.
Oh, that's not the other skyscraper.
That's a skyscraper. No, this guy's a short Olympic guy. He on the Olympic training team, but he trains out in San Diego with those guys, and he has like a Greco style that he's adapted for MMA, and it's really slick and it's really sweet. And Cheeto's one of his students, and I was hoping to see some of that technique displayed, and he did some of it, but there's a whole nother level that Cheeto could have hit.
Yeah, Song Yadong in some ways survived this fight, but he did land those nice counter right hands. I mean, it was a good ass fight. Miguel Baeza really jumped off the screen here, improving. He stays unbeaten, knocks out Matt Brown in the second round. But he had gotten knocked down himself early in that first round. And, like, this was the perfect level matchmaking. Brown, the hard-nosed veteran. Yeah. We love ourselves some of the immortal Matt Brown. But coming in on a two-fight win streak against the unbeaten, unheralded guy, does he have it? Man, Baeza showed you something in that one.
Man, I was so impressed. I was really so impressed. I mean, just to make it through what he made it through, that adversity against a guy like Matt Brown, who's straight killer. You know, not many people can say they survived a Matt Brown attack, and he survived it. And then to come back with his own finish, and as if like, all right, you caught me slipping, but this is what I really got. And it showed that he's going to be a force in his weight class for sure.
What do you think about this guy, Kevin Holland, the middleweight, who destroyed Anthony Hernandez in less than one round? I wasn't too woke to his backstory outside of knowing his name. I know he had some up and downs in the UFC, but this was like know me now type of performance.
Yeah, I was surprised. I was really surprised with that, and especially since I have such I thought Hernandez was going to be that guy, and it's just it's because I see so much potential in him, but you know, he still has to, still has to go through that. But I was impressed, man. That was just, it showed that these guys, you know, there's so much talent in the UFC that we don't even know about that's just coming and keep on coming. It's amazing.
I give them credit for that contender series, because it's just thrown people at us.
Yes.
You know, arriving in like parachutes, and you're like, oh, that guy's a badass.
Yeah, where'd he come from?
Forces you to be a badass. You don't get Dana's attention. You can win, as we know, in that series and not get the contract. You have to be, I mean, and here's like, Dana knows what he's doing. He's grooming fighters to not fight for the decision. He's grooming the anti-John
mentality.
World. Yeah. It's very interesting. Shout out to Giga Chikadze and Irwin Rivera, who fought a nice little featherweight war. But the name who seemed to dominate the tweets in the undercard here was this fella, Nate the Train Landwehr. He's a featherweight. He went in there against Darren the Damage Elkins, who, for the love of God, we love ourselves some Darren Elkins, but that guy will run face first into a car and just take it as his blood and guts are literally falling out of his body. I don't have a problem with that, because that's who Elkins is, right? Remember that the old idealism, take three to give one? He takes about 34 to give one. But I had a problem with Nate Landwehr acting like he's suddenly Roy Jones because he can light up Darren Elkins, Rashad. He's putting his arms behind his back. He's trash talking. Yelling Dana's name at the top of his lungs. And it just so happened, and I wish I had the sound ready, that he had that Southern Hick voice. And, you know, but that's too far. Like, this ain't young Conor McGregor, you know, knocking out Diego Brandão and trying to get Dana's attention and saying, pay me. this seemed like some hick from French Lick that just rolled in here. And just because you bloodied up Darren Elkins, bro, you almost gassed out from celebrating too much. Get that guy off my screen, Rashad.
Yeah, I feel you, man. I feel you. And that's the thing about it. Like, he took his moment and he's like, you know what? I'm going to shine. I'm going to act a fool out here. I want to get the attention. But I don't think it worked out for him. I don't think it looked as good as or as cool as he hoped it would be, man.
Lame. You know what it was reminiscent of? Remember when Mike Jackson beat up CM Punk and was like taunting him and trash talking?
Yes, that's exactly
what it was.
Dana was like,
you're never fighting in this place again.
Yeah, it was terrible. And especially, it was bad move.
Bad stuff altogether. Also, shout out to Courtney Casey, who shared the performance of the night bonus along with Miguel Baeza. She had a nice looking armbar submission in the first round against Mara Romero Barella. You see, Barella had the body tats going up and down. She, visits the tattoo parlor very often. Wow, shout out. Oh, hey, what? Sorry, it was accident. Just kind of shut off there for a second. My bad on that one completely. You know what happens in a podcast at any point, Rashad,
He shot us low. And now he's getting laying down the stretch. Do what we do best.
When did you think this fight was starting to turn? When he had shot his load?
Okay, thank you. Rashad, we got a lot of headlines this week. Let's talk first about the UFC schedule. We know we are off this weekend. We're going to be right back the weekend after, and you have to believe, again, it's going to be every weekend for the rest of the year to get back on schedule. But this fight night card, May 30th, right now doesn't have a home. We think it's former welterweight champion Tyron Woodley against Gilbert Burns in the main event, which would be a banger. Need to see that. I mean, legitimately very good fight. Dana said late Saturday that, hey, we had a good time in Florida, but we're out. Okay, we're done. Thank you, City of Jacksonville. We all know they want to go to the UFC Apex like we talked at the top of the show, but he says we will go to Arizona if that's what we have to do. Again, doesn't this tell Nevada, like, no, UFC is a homegrown organization. They are Las Vegas.
Right.
Do your fights here. Don't do it over there. Don't load up the 18-wheelers and go to Arizona. Like, come on. Change the damn laws already.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, like I was saying at the top of the show, it just absolutely makes no sense. I mean, especially if it's, Gilbert Burns and Tyron Woodley, because that one is going to be a great fight. But more importantly, the more that they disconnect themselves from the headlines of what the UFC is doing, the more that they don't benefit from anything off the headlines. It's just kind of it doesn't make any sense.
But it's good to know we at least have a home, meaning Arizona, that's close by to Vegas. UFC is ready, willing, and able to put on that fight night card. We'll see that. Obviously, the week after, June 6th, is UFC 250. From what we know now, it's looking like Amanda Nunes, Felicia Spencer. It's also looking like that card would be in the U.S., given those who are on it and their locations. Do we know anything else about that card? What could be the potential big-name co-main event? I think I've only really heard Amanda at this point.
Nah, that's all I heard, too, is Amanda. I haven't heard really too many anybody else.
So this is going to be interesting because Dana's saying that Fight Island is going to be ready by mid-June and hopes to have it operational by late June. So, he even went as far a couple days ago in saying when Habib fights Justin Gaethje, which we know can't really happen until August, based on what they both said. And, of course, Habib's still observing Ramadan through May 23rd. Dana wants to put that on Fight Island. That would be he said it wouldn't be the first card, but that would be a hell of an event that I think would draw the pay-per-view buys, even separate from it being Habib and Justin Gaethje. When they do that in August on Fight Island, people are going to care. People are going to really care.
I mean, I think if you're going to announce something like Fight Island, I mean, you're going to have an event, a first event at something called Fight Island, you have to have it start off with a blockbuster like Justin Gaethje and Habib, right?
Absolutely. I'm just fired up that we're back. And it feels good. It feels good, man. It's funny. I was walking the dogs with my wife this morning, and I was trying to debate, what is the new normal going to be in our life? Certainly before we can fill arenas again, which could end up being a year for all we know, maybe even more. You never really know. What elements of our life do you think are going to change the most that may never – Like, I mean, like, as things stand now, I could not see myself getting on a train or a subway. I could not see myself going to a concert or going to a theme park again. I mean, do you see any other areas in your life where you're like, this will change maybe for the good from this situation?
Oh, man, I can't think of a lot offhand that I think can change for the good. I think maybe just people being more conscientious of just you know, being health, I guess being more, you know, clean.
Yeah.
But I think outside of that, I think it's going to be kind of weird because, you know, a big part of who we are as humans is interacting with each other. And when we can't interact with each other, it kind of hurts humanity a bit, you know?
Maybe it'll force us to keep our circles tighter, Rashad.
Yeah, maybe.
Get everybody checked out. Swab everyone in the nose. Scrape the brain as they walk in the front door. Either way, I know I'll probably have to end up taking that test at some point to do something, right? Whether it be cover a big card or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm going to do everything in my power never to take that test, Rashad. That's not an ignorant response to the legit fear of COVID. I'm just not ready to have something stuck deep down my
into your brain, right? Where does that stick go?
On video, Dana posted it. He was like, third time in 8 days, here we go. And I'm just like, nah, not me, bro.
It's like this long. Yeah, like, whoa, where does that go?
From my house, it's fine. It's fine. All right, let's look at the headlines in the sport. I think the biggest headline right now is the fact that this potential Francis Ngannou, John Jones heavyweight bout went from, here's the timeline, little trash talk back and forth. John Jones on Twitter criticizing OSP's performance as a heavyweight, making reference to, if I was in there against Francis or a big hitter, Francis responded. They go back and forth. But late Saturday, Dana White in the post-fight press conference in Jacksonville was like, in response to being asked about it, said, look, you know, I don't think either of these guys really even want that fight. People talk on Twitter. Well, then Abe Kawa, John's co-manager, tweets out, oh, no, we want that fight. Then John on Monday tweets out, send the deal, you know? Rashad, does he really want that smoke? Is this really a thing? Could this really happen? This is like on the short list of the best possible fights to make.
I know. Listen, if John Jones really does this, it'd be amazing. It'd be amazing. It'd be the challenge that the fans were looking to see from John Jones. I mean, you know, and it sounds crazy to say, you know, and it sounds very dismissive of what he's already currently done. And, that's really weird to say, but at the same time, it's nevertheless the situation. You know what I'm saying? It is what it is. You know, people feel that way. And I feel like, you know, this would be something that would get a lot of people to really look at him in a different light, you know. But about the matchup, it'd be an interesting matchup to see this fight happen, because Francis, you can't take too many shots from him at all, not if one at all, you know.
And, you know, look, there's a debate to be had, and I'm ready to have it with you right now about how John would deal in general with heavyweights, with the harder punching and the slower, you know, combat. But Francis Ngannou doesn't fit that question, because Francis Ngannou has freak-like explosion, has alternate angles that just sort of come out of nowhere. I mean, he's got a lot of different stuff there. But part of John's assault on Twitter over the past 2 days of seemingly saying he's ready for this, he's posted videos where he's back to powerlifting again, and he said he's 240 and ripped. He also made multiple references of, how much would you pay for this? You know, pay me to make it worth it. And here's where I think he's right, Rashad, because there's levels to the UFC pay system. And we've talked at length about, you know, in some ways there's the have and have nots. There's the title level, championship level guys who get paid so well that they're no longer going to help the people below them who are struggling and climbing because they're like, I made it. But then even within that realm, there's levels to this, right? There's Conor McGregor's super levels, and there's a hierarchy in there. I'm not against John Jones, who has put himself on the line against dangerous competition over and over and consistently seemed to make, right, you know, 2-4 million with bonuses, probably, you know, maybe for his biggest paydays made more, saying, I want what is, you know, Conor type money. And if I'm going to take this challenge for you, pay me. Yes, they should pay him. In my mind, Rashad, and again, I don't have access to the UFC's books, but I come from a sport in boxing where when you get to this level, the Mayweather-Pacquiao level, I'm not saying pay him $100 million, right? But Mayweather and Pacquiao had that run over the last decade where it didn't matter who they were fighting, they were getting $20 million as a minimum, right? Because that's the draw. Now, I know UFC puts on deeper cards, but I also know UFC pays their fighters a such lower percentage that if I'm John Jones, I'm saying, yes, pay me $15 to $20 million if you want to see me in there with Ngannou. It's time that I get the crossover superstar money. Is that crazy?
No, and listen, I agree. He should get that money. He should get that money. But let's make no mistake about it. Conor's not getting that money for no reason. He's getting that money because he's bringing that attention, you know. And that's just fair as I can say it. You know, he's bringing whole countries over to America, spending massive amount of money, and you know that's just the people who came over here. So he has the ability to make people open up their wallets. True. John Jones does not have that same ability. Now, could this fight potentially garner that kind of attention, garner that kind of, hype around it where people would pay to see it? Yeah, it could, but I don't know. I don't know if it's something that the UFC is going to lead with first. I'm like, all right, you know, we're going to give you this money and to see if you can, you know, make it be what you think it can be. I like the fight. I just don't believe that John Jones is 100% sincere about really doing it. I think he's doing those things where he's gauging. You know, he's gauging. Now, look,
in the past, he has made comments about being willing to fight Stipe next and big announcement coming, send me the money, and not gone through with it. So you could be right. John has played. John knows his standing. John knows how to play social media. He knows what he's doing, indeed, when it comes to that. Not everything John knows what he's doing.
No more dick pics. No dick
pics, please. But he does. But I think, look, this goes back to the debates, you know, I've had for the past couple of years that, like, there's really not much more to gain, right, legacy-wise or even financially by staying in light heavyweight. In fact, what we've seen over the last year is John may end up gaining a loss, right? Because this group of guys of Dom Reyes, Maheda, you know, all these guys, they're dangerous enough, but don't seem to bring a ton of, high-end value where it's kind of a high-risk, low-reward proposition. He's already cleaned out the division twice. We know his true potential is to win a heavyweight championship, retire as the GOAT. He's the GOAT now, but it's an argument. There will not be an argument if he goes up and wins the heavyweight championship and retires as the GOAT, right? It'll be the. So he'll get more money. Every heavyweight fight for him will have that extra intrigue of danger. Just like any time we saw great boxers, you know, welterweights move up in weight and go up to middleweight, you know, just any, it's the same type of thing. There's intrigue in there. Right. And here's the other reason why I think he should. Said it before, Rashad, say it once more. John Jones beats every single heavyweight, including Francis Ngannou. I'm sorry, he does. Even though the light heavyweights are closing the gap on him due to maybe speed and youth and athleticism, even though John's IQ, defense, and chin remain top shelf, I feel the advantage he will have compared to heavyweights in those departments will basically make him Floyd Mayweather out there in terms of he'll have to be a smart boxer. No, you can't take flush shots from Ngannou. Nobody can, okay? Maybe Stipe took that one and he barely hung on. No one's taking those shots, all right? I don't think John's going to get hit is my point. I think he is too sophisticated as a kickboxer and as a striker. I think he's going to be able to he's got to show technique. It's not going to be knockouts per se, although he can certainly catch people running into a head kick. But Rashad, I feel like he's going to paint these guys.
I mean, he very well could. He definitely has the technique and, you know, in the skill and just knowledge. You know, he's one of the smartest fighters I ever fought. So he definitely has that ability to do all those things. And I think at the light heavyweight division, you know, he has cleaned up the division twice. And now he's kind of looking at a situation like Mighty Mouse, you know, it was. And Mighty Mouse is, you know, in my opinion, one of the best to ever do it. But he'd never be recognized for what he was and what he was able to do just because no one really respected, you know, no one really cared too much about the weight class. And I think John Jones is in that position right now with this group of light heavyweights. You know, not saying they're terrible fighters, but at the same time, just the care is gone for the division. You know, it's just not that blockbuster division anymore. So I think in order to get that attention, he may need to go up to heavyweight, and I think it's the best thing for him to do. And I think here's the thing with John, though, and this is the psychology part of it. This is the psychology part of it. Does he have enough confidence to compete with guys who's bigger than him? And that's the thing about it. And I say that because
that's a fair point. We've never seen that, right?
Yeah, and a fair point is this right here. When someone uses something like a steroid or something like that, is because they don't want to feel like they're smaller than the other person. So it's a psychological thing. You know what I'm saying? So psychologically speaking, can he put himself in a position where he knows he's going into the octagon and he is a smaller fighter?
That is very interesting. He will have to dig deep to do this. And I'm not, again, underscoring at all what Ngannou brings to the table, which is the ability to knock any human out at any point with what he brings. But, yeah, if he's going to do this, then this is one of those rare times that I say put the interim title at stake. Because, you know, Stipe needs time to train. I think DC deserves that trilogy. I think that's the fight to make so you can allow DC a chance to close his career on his own terms. If he loses, he retires. If he wins... Oh, good God, Rashad. Then we could be talking about DC John 3 at heavyweight. Oh, my God. Let's slow the train on that one. Yeah, please put an interim title. Give John the $20 million or $15 million, whatever it takes. Give it to him. Let's do this fight. I think Ngannou has shown you enough over the past four fights that you run that highlight reel. If no one's ever heard of him, they will. And then you run that story on ESPN, which is an incredible story of moving to France from Africa and sleeping in his car and, you know, having gone through the UFC propped him up only for him to lose badly and sort of, you know, get humbled. I mean, he's got a great story a physical freak of nature. Is he the scariest human? Like, if we took every MMA fighter ever and had them take their shirts off and have the average Joe stand up in front of him, he's got to be the scariest human to ever enter that
damn. He is the scariest, but honestly, he's probably one of the nicest, one of the best people that I've met in the game. Just because he's got a very soft nature about himself. You know what I'm saying? And that's and it's something you don't even expect. You know, and he's unexpectedly funny too. So. It's Francis is a good guy, man, a real good guy.
Final thought on this John Jones thing. He doesn't really wrestle anymore in general, right?
Right.
It takes up a lot of energy. He's figured out a defensive boxing style, and if you let him walk you down, he'll walk you down and get you out of there. Would he need to, and could he wrestle at a very high level against heavyweights if he came in absolutely jacked and ripped at 240?
Yeah, he definitely can. I think John Jones, you know, that's a tool in his toolbox. But at the same time, I don't think he's going to be taking shots and shooting underneath heavyweights. I think he'll utilize his clinch game with his trips and stuff that he's really good at. You know, John has a whole trip game, inside trip game, and Greco game that he rarely ever uses. And I think he would be able to utilize that on some of these heavyweights and throw them off balance.
Just look at that gap. Once DC came back to heavyweight and you saw the hand speed, you saw that, you know, he's dealing when DC's fighting a light heavyweight, he's dealing with speed. I mean, he's dealing with explosion at heavyweight. That I feel like that's the biggest gap between weight classes to a large degree where it slows down a little bit.
It does. The hand speed and just that fatigue bar is a huge one thing too. You know, the energy level. If you figure out how to maximize how to use your energy, then you can just use off of just, you know, being able to allocate your energy at the right amount of time. And a lot of heavyweights, they go into energy deprivation because they mess up this unique balance.
I hope we do it. I hope we see that. The other thing related to John Jones was Chael Sonnen, who, I mean, we love ourselves some Chael Sonnen personally.
Never piss off a gangster.
He came at John on like a 15.
He always comes at John.
This was like, I'm coming for you. And then John's responding with gifts of Sonnen and getting, you know, tapped out and beat up. What's Chael's angle here? Is it just like, watch my clips? Is that all it is?
I don't know. You know, Chael does not like John. And he always, no matter what, finds something to say about John. You know, he's got a bunch of ad hominem names for him, and he just goes at him every single chance that he gets.
I mean, I'm looking up and down these tweets, and it's like, I mean, he's talking about jail. He's talking about everyone knows you beat this latest case by ratting out, which is reference to what Chael believes John did with USADA, ratted wow. out to get his thing shortened. He says, if you ever drove sober, the networks would cover it live with helicopters. I mean, look, they're low blows, but
wow, he's going at him like that.
Oh yeah, you have permanent handcuff creases in your wrists. It's interesting. Some of it wow. is more funny, but some of it is hard hitting. But that is Chael. We have to remember every time he posts one of those videos of him breaking something down, he's getting paid ad money. So maybe it's yeah. all related to that. Chael is a smart gangster indeed. Up and down the MMA news is unfortunately, you know, we continue to pray for Khabib Nurmagomedov's father, who is in critical condition and was in a coma. And now the family is going public, Rashad, and saying it's because of COVID-19 symptoms. So that is, that ain't good. You know, Abdulmanap is the correct name. He underwent heart surgery due to the complications from a previous ailment. He also has the coronavirus. So we wish that family well in a hopeful recovery on that regard. Conor McGregor has been active on tweets lately, Rashad. Not much new to report, but Justin Gaethje did come out and say that he feels the fighters are kind of over Conor. That that they've almost gone past him. Meaning, like, hey, Conor, you had your chance before I beat Tony, but you want nothing to do with me, and now you're tweeting out that you think you're going to slide and fight me. And Justin basically said, I could fight Conor next if I wanted to. I could tell the UFC I wanted them next, and they would do that. But no, get in line, basically. I like that stance.
Yeah, I mean, listen, fighters are tired of jumping through the hoops of whatever Conor wants just because they can align themselves with a good paycheck. You know, I think now that fighters are like, look, you know, at some point I'm going to get that belt, and at that point I'll get the money that I deserve. But I'm not going to jump through these hoops that this guy wants me to jump through, because when it was time to fight, he didn't want to fight, but now he wants to have his hand raised because now he's seen that I went in there and did something that he was afraid to do. You know, and that's where Justin's coming from. He's like, you know, this guy, he wants to act as if like he really wants this, but when it was time for him to sign for it, he didn't want no part of it.
Yeah, I agree with that. We're still debating about what could be, what should be next for Conor. He did make a couple tweets when Showtime last Friday re-aired the Mayweather-McGregor boxing match. And you know, there's a lot of traffic with that on social media and clips being put out. Conor responded with, you know, sort of like revisionist history about how many rounds he had won and how good he looked and all that. But did say, I'm going to do a lot better the second time. I mean, is there smoke and fire to that? And look, I don't doubt that Floyd would and might come back again. And if he did in boxing, he's only going to fight somebody like a McGregor where he would have a distinct advantage. But would UFC, what power do you think they have? Would Dana, he certainly wouldn't want McGregor to go into a boxing match later this year, right? Even though the UFC may be able to make money off of that, Conor just blew out Cowboy. You want him right back in the mix, you know, whether it's fighting a Nate Diaz or looking to fight the winner of Khabib Justin. Do you think Dana has the sway? How do things really work? Could he keep Conor out of this if this was something Conor wanted to do? Is that even a smart idea to change disciplines once again, Rashad?
Well, I think he can definitely keep Conor out of it, but I think if he was going to allow it to happen, he would definitely have a part in it. You know, they have that Zuffa boxing that they've been trying to launch off the ground, or, you know, talk about they were going to do. And they also spoke about Mayweather being a part of it. So maybe a second fight could be something that Conor does in the meantime until the Khabib and Justin Gaethje fight get underway. You know, with everything that Khabib has going on, it doesn't look like he may be able to fight until, you know, the fall, you know, just to kind of digest everything emotionally speaking and just, you know, everything else. So it might be something that makes sense for them to do if you want to make it so that you increase the value of Conor McGregor, but then you don't hurt his value by having him lose against somebody else who's not the champion.
I just don't think they could do a fight that big without the live gate, right? I mean, that's such a large percentage of it.
Well, think about it. It's a large gate, but now imagine that large gate being at home and having to pay for that pay-per-view. Fair. And now you're getting the numbers on pay-per-view that you used to get way back in the day, you know? And then now I think that equation balances out better than the live gate.
What the first fight do? 4.4 or 4.6 million pay-per-view buys. The second fight, the absolute basement is 2 million buys. Like, obviously, you know, I mean, it could do,
right.
And if it's well promoted, and I mean, it could be anywhere. It could be 3 million, 4 million. It could be anything in that.
I mean, it'd be a worldwide event once again. And now the fact that the world has become even smaller now with this whole COVID-19 situation, you know, it'd be huge.
You say something else, I'll whip your ass in the octagon, bitch.
Rewatching that fight, Mayweather-McGregor, you know, 3 years removed, I'm still in that same debate mode where I can't figure out how much Floyd carried Connor. Meaning, right. Connor won the first 3.5 rounds pretty clearly, but wasn't hurting him. And, you know, Floyd certainly wanted to see Connor, what he had, wanted to allow him to gas out a bit. And then once Floyd started walking forward behind his high guard, he knew he had skill advantages up the kazoo, and he tired Connor out. Well, you know what happened. He finished him. How much of that was like, let me allow you to get to the late rounds, you know, to do that? I still don't know. And I still don't know how that would affect a rematch, except for the fact that Floyd's a little older. I would have to think Connor would be better than he was the first fight.
Yeah, I think Connor would be better, but let's make no mistakes about it. You know, Floyd is head and shoulders above Mayweather above Connor on his worst day. So I do think he did carry him considerable. But I also believe that Connor did do some things that made him had to legit, you know, have to, you know what I'm saying, to respect. Right, but like
Mayweather's no dummy. He had to see what Connor had in the first.
Yeah, couple. Yeah, for sure. For sure. For sure.
I guess the real question on the idea of the carrying is, had Floyd decided the first fight, and if he wanted to decide that if there was a second fight, could he have walked in there and finished him within 3 rounds if he wanted to exchange right off the start?
I think he could have, but that goes against everything Floyd Mayweather is. You know what I'm saying? Floyd Mayweather didn't get 50-0 by taking chances, and that's just the truth of the matter. So there's no way, no matter how bad he thought he had advantage over McGregor, he's going to walk in there and do the best 3 rounds of boxing like we see in Hagler versus Hearns. No way.
It's like, it's part of me is like, you know, why would he go back? Why would Connor go back to that except for the money when he's really in a position to fight the winner of Khabib and Justin? But
whenever that may be, whenever that may be,
why take the gamble on fighting somebody else? I don't know, it's interesting. It's going to be very interesting how they pull this off. Obviously, the empty arenas play into the decision-making for sure. UFC Hall of Fame announced its Pioneer-era representative. We've already seen George St. Pierre getting in. We've already seen the John Jones-Alexander Gustafsson first fight. This time, it's the late Kevin Randleman, the fifth UFC heavyweight champion in history. Rashad, we remember the wrestling ability, the explosiveness, the blonde-dyed hair, which you have to remember, that was a big part of allowing him to stand out early on. You're like, oh, I know that guy. What is your memory of the great Kevin Randleman?
Oh, my goodness. You know, Kevin Randleman was one of those athletes, one of those black athletes who really made me believe that I can do it. You know, back in the day, it was dominated, and there was no black people really in the sport. And you've seen Kevin Randleman come on the scene. He comes in there with his blonde hair, and as a black kid, I'm like, yes, this is okay. We can do this too. So it was huge for me. It was huge for me. And when I got a chance to meet Kevin Randleman, it was bigger than life for me, because, you know, he was a fan of me, and I'm like, dude, I've been watching you since you slammed, you know, Fedor on his head and all those things, and
he dropped Fedor on his.
Oh my god!
Head. I mean, like, come on.
He should have paralyzed Fedor with that spike on his head, man. But Kevin Randleman was a man, and it's really unfortunate that he's not with us anymore. But his legacy is definitely with us.
Yeah, incredible personality. Died in 2016 at age 44. He was hospitalized for pneumonia. There were reports that he died of heart complications, but I have seen his wife his widow has reached out to media and said like that was an erroneous report. It wasn't necessarily that. Either way, maybe his biggest moment of his career was knocking out Fedor. I'm sorry, knocking out Prokop.
That was a
big win. That was an upset win. He did win the UFC Heavyweight Championship in 1999 by defeating Pete Williams. How about that name? At UFC 23 in Japan, defended it once, lost it to Randy Couture the next year, and a two-time All-American national champion at Ohio State. The credentials were real. That was back when wrestling dominated the sport. Rashad.
Yeah.
Them wrestlers, right, with the boots on? I mean, they can't. indeed. Speaking of that, Vitor Belfort, I watched an interview with him on Bloody Elbow the other day. You know, he's going to make that comeback in one championship coming up soon against a kickboxer that I haven't heard of who's like 5-4 in MMA. But he's saying it's going to be some kind of mixed rules thing where you can wear shoes and it's like boxing and kickboxing mixed together. And he's hoping more old guy fights go that route. I don't know. This is the guy that's been propositioning for a Legends League for some time.
Right.
You've been
anywhere? I mean, I talked to Vitor. I haven't talked to him in a while, but we talked quite a bit. I got to ask him about that because I haven't heard that he's going to do all these rules. It'd be interesting to see, though. I think that'd be really interesting to see.
Yeah. It did get confirmed, by the way. Ariel Helwani of ESPN reports that the May 30th UFC Fight Night card will be Gilbert Burns and Tyron Woodley in the main event. Rashad, what I love about that is Woodley at 38 certainly has a lot to prove. Long layoff, got one-sided demolition against Kamaru. Yet he may be like one win away from another title opportunity with a win. I mean, he beats a rising Gilbert Burns. Tyron Woodley's a perfect opponent right there for Kamaru, whoever has the title. Yet Gilbert Burns, if he wins this, he put the rocket strap on him.
Yeah, Gilbert Burns has been really chopping at the bit for this fight too. You know, he's been trying to get it for a while. With tweets, with IG posts, anything he can to kind of poke the bear that is Tyron Woodley. And Tyron hasn't said too much. And then, you know, he finally accepted a fight. But I think that, this is a different Tyron. You know, Tyron is kind of turned the situation that happened to him with losing a fight and everything that he's gone through in the last few years. And he's kind of got a chip on the shoulder, a huge chip on the shoulder. And it kind of, you can't see anything from Tyron Woodley without seeing it spew out. You know, he just kind of enraged right now. And he's going against a very tough Gilbert Burns, who's believing in himself at another level and training alongside the now champ. So he's dealing with a different kind of confidence going into this fight as well, because he's training alongside the man who demoralized Tyron Woodley in the beginning. So this is going to be an interesting matchup, but I think Tyron's going to have to do a job of just mentally clearing himself out and not going into this fight with such a menacing attitude, because I think that could do him some harm.
Will age be a factor? Are we going to see him, get old overnight and slow down?
You know,
taking a ton of damage.
He has, but Tyron is very smart about the way he trains, and he takes care of his body. So I think when it comes time, I think his body's going to be pretty good, but it's going to be interesting to see, mentally speaking, how is he after, being in a fight like he was with Kamaru. You know what I'm saying? It's hard. It's because when you get the brakes beat off you like that, it takes a while to kind of mentally get through that, because you may be out there, you may have a flashback of, that ass whooping that happened, and that's real. That's real stuff. And those are all things that make you perform not to your best ability.
Interesting. Also in the news, Henry Cejudo, fresh off that quote unquote retirement, now manager to the stars, Ali Abdelaziz tells TMZ, I don't think he's going to retire after all. He's already talking to me. Who should I fight next? And he said, quote, I believe Henry Cejudo will return to the octagon this summer. That's an interesting turn of events here, Rashad.
Was there ever any doubt? Listen, Henry Cejudo, man, he's in his element right now. You know, he's flourishing right now as far as I'm coming into his own as a person, and I think, with the whole, Triple C and all that, he's kind of, he's this persona is growing and growing, and he's having fun playing his character.
If Alexander Volkanovski defeats Max Holloway a second time, would the UFC in your eyes allow Henry to become the first man to have a chance at being a three division champion? Is that some kind of, I mean, obviously it's like hallowed ground, but it's not like, no, we need to save Connor for that. I mean, do you think Cejudo would get that? They would give him that chance?
No, they wouldn't. And they wouldn't do it. I'm going to tell you why. Because he's already made it about money for them. They would never give him an opportunity to make it even more about more money for them.
Well, that's why they've been successful. It's for better or worse. Also in the news, I don't know if you saw this, but the referee Jason Herzog, who officiated the Anthony Smith bout against Glover Teixeira, in which he took a heavy beating, he came out and he basically took responsibility. He was like, "It's on me. I'm the referee. I should have looked out for Anthony Smith more. You don't have to blame anybody else but me." So I thought that was a stand-up move. I don't know if he's right. Seems like you can throw a lot of blame at Anthony Smith's corner, which we talked about. But Anthony Smith responded by saying, quote, "That's a coward move of the referee for addressing the whole thing." What?
I don't know. I don't follow that sentiment, but I think I don't know. I don't even know how to take what he might be saying in that whole thing. But you know, I think maybe he's trying to say that the referee shouldn't take blame for that, and it was on me to make that choice, or my coach to make that choice. But I agree. I think the referee did his job that night. I don't think that he allowed the fight to go on based upon what Anthony was showing him. And Anthony was still showing him that he was still able to fight and that he wanted to fight. That's what it appeared to be.
Here's the full quote here. It was on Twitter. It was Anthony responding to some fans talking about it. He said, "Coward move on his part, in my opinion. I make it a point before fights to know the commands and what he," meaning referee Jason Herzog, "expects out of each one before every fight. I did everything he asked and responded correctly per the pre-fight meeting. Don't wilt under a little heat afterwards because Twitter is mean. The world is soft. Man up."
Okay, I get it now. I get the context on what he's saying now. So what he's saying is this right here. Look, you didn't do anything wrong. You were doing your job. It was not your fault. Now don't try to act as if like it was your fault and you did something. Now don't get under the pressure and be like, "I should have watched out." I get it. I get that.
All right. I mean, look, I thought, you know, yeah, no, I get it, Joe. I do get the premise of what he's saying. Whatever. It's a tweet. Who cares? Let's roll on. That is the show for this week. Oh, the other thing I want to tell you, Dan Ige wants Korean Zombie. That'd be a hell of a step. That would, yeah, I'm here for that. Indeed. Rashad, we wrapped up The Last Dance, the 10-part ESPN Michael Jordan documentary. We've all been transfixed. Do you have any parting shots on that incredible, 20 hours of footage we watched there?
No, it was amazing, man. You know, I'm rewatching it again just so I can, you know, get some nuggets out of it. But just to watch the mentality of those guys and just watch all the elements that came into play to make their story what it was is amazing. But the amount of respect for Michael Jordan, just his mentality, like what, man, who, wow.
So here's the deal. I get that right before it aired, he did a couple of public interviews on some really high level shows. And he was like, "I'm a little nervous. People are going to think I'm an asshole." And you know, you understand it. They're going to tell the story of him punching his teammates in practice and tell the story of him being a tyrant in terms of like getting everybody to raise their level. But I thought it was so perfectly offset with the reasons why. And his reasons why was, you know, after he hit that shot against Utah to win the third straight championship, the sixth in 8 years, Phil Jackson hugs him and they got the mics close and you can hear what they're saying. And Phil's like, "That was beautiful." And Michael just kept saying, I had faith. I never stopped believing. And to be able to see that full story being told of just how much that Bulls team was running on fumes, just how much Michael at 35 was carrying them game to game. They were exhausted. They'd just gone through 7 games against the Pacers. Now they go 6 games against the Jazz. And Michael the whole time was like, "I had faith. I believed." And I think that helped me understand him and respect him so much more, because we've all been, whether it be, you know, your job or coaches or teammates, whatever, in sports, you've always had those people that are just crazy competitors. And it's like they're one dimensional and it's like all or nothing. And if you screw up, they're in your face. And I'm no doubt that Michael's you could see him picking on players. Like he could be a bully for sure.
Yeah.
But I think it was always offset by the idea that like, I will not allow negative thinking to come into my space. We have a chance to win every single time we step out there, and it's our duty to get as close to that as we can. Like I was motivated by, I was ready like at 11 at night to like, "All right, where's the weights? Where's the bench? Let's get back. All right, let's start this thing up," you know?
And if you watch that, and that's why I'm watching it again, is because, you know, just picking up the nuggets in that series, you can see the blueprint of success. And it comes down to, you know, the fundamental things and just perseverance and just belief, you know, a belief in yourself and doing what you believe is right. And that's what, you know, Michael was doing. And he focused on those things and everyone else is hanging out, partying, having fun. He went home and he cleaned his house and he worked on those things to help him get better.
Oh, he figured out how to party a little bit. I'm a little skeptical of this flu game, quote unquote.
Right.
No, yeah, there may have been pizza there. There may have also been eight women. Okay, you know what I'm saying? Say like he's the Black Jesus at that point. So he could, but I think you're right. I think it makes us all how we apply to our own life and our jobs and our own walk and whatever we're competing in or trying to do. There's certainly a lot you can take from that. And we already know it's 90% mental, everything you do in life, but it really reassured to me that like, okay, you have to have talent. You have to have insane work ethic. You have to have all those things. You have to have luck, connections to get somewhere in life, but your core, you got to stand for something. You have to believe no matter what that you're going to get there. And it's like, I mean, this guy's just, there's no room. There's no room for negativity. The best part of that whole thing was his anger at the team the year he injured his ankle.
Yeah.
And he thought they were tanking. That it's like, that's against everything I believe. And I'm like, that's me right there. That is against everything I believe in. The idea that you would lose for some higher purpose. No, we would play to win the game.
Right.
And, you know, he never lost that intensity. He never changed that. And that's, you know, we all may not have the ability in the end in whatever we do of a Michael Jordan, but I think we can model that, Rashad. All right.
It's the mindset that can be mimicked. And that's what it goes back to, the Black Mamba mentality, but it's that mindset that you can mimic, that can make you a Michael Jordan, whatever you choose to put your mind to.
Water is wet, fire burns, and I'm going to be Michael Bisping.
Very true. The fourth one is you believe Rashad Payne can happen. Right? I believe in the show. I believe in Rashad at 40, by the way. I don't know if I want – look, as your poll worker, I don't know if I want you to get back in the cage unless somebody's getting a receipt, all right? So look up and down that Wikipedia page. We'll figure out who's deserving it, all right? Leodo, don't get pretty, Leodo, okay?
Welcome to the Machida era.
No, Machida era over, okay?
It's over.
Rashad 2.0 era, maybe. Just maybe. Closing the camera right there. All right, follow us at State of Combat on Twitter, at Sugar Rashad Evans on all your Instagram and channels. And you posted shirtless pics these days. Got to be careful as a married man doing that.
No, not yet. I got to tighten it up a little bit.
Those DMs clean, okay? We don't want to know what goes down there. Shout out to our producer, Mikey Mormile. We, of course, will be back next week. Always looking to line up big interviews for you. Get a little weekend off. Enjoy your Memorial Day. Fights will return on the other side. We're trying to be the best.
No, that's it, DC. I think we covered it.
Yeah, we covered it all. Okay, so I got two words for you people, all right?
We out.
Baseball has begun, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today in 5, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Sample, every Monday through Saturday as we deliver all of your fantasy baseball needs in just 5 minutes. We'll break down the biggest performers, news, and prospects who could make an impact this season. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.